Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. While health care is heatedly debated in town hall meetings, hundreds of people spent the night lining up on a sidewalk to receive it. The free medical, dental, and vision clinic being held in the Forum in Inglewood, California this week opens at 5:30 a.m. and is expected to treat up to 2,000 people a day through Saturday. The free care is provided by Remote Area Medical. That's a Tennessee-based nonprofit that's staged nearly 600 clinics over the last 25 years. Most of them in rural areas in the U.S. or in developing countries. This is the first time the group has gone to an American urban setting, and it gives some insight into who the un- and underinsured in America are. Don Minnelli is a member of Remote Area Medical, the event's organizer as well. He is with us. Don, describe the scene in the Forum. I'm looking at pictures and seeing what looks like a mile of cots.
Those cots are actually dental chairs. There's 84 on the floor. In the parking lot, we have the USC dental vans with another 20 chairs. So we have a lot of dentists, and we're pulling a lot of teeth and doing a lot of fillings. We're doing root canals. We're doing restorative. We're even making dentures.
What else are you doing? People can picture the Forum, this huge arena. What else are you doing there?
We're doing vision care. You can come in and get a prescription, and we'll actually grind the lenses right there. You pick out your frames, and you walk out with a pair of glasses.
What are some of the medical things that are happening, the medical procedures?
There's two major thrusts. One is just, we obviously can't do surgery, but there's consultation. We do diabetes testing, blood pressures, all of that. We're doing mammograms, women's health. If somebody, it's an important point, if somebody comes in and we discover that they have glaucoma during the eye exam or that they've got elevated blood sugar or whatever, we find someplace for them to go and get the continuing care that they need.
What are people telling you? We know Los Angeles has an unemployment rate of 22%. The state has been hit hard. But Los Angeles is also the center of the film industry. So are these... You know, to play devil's advocate here, are these 25-year-old wannabe actors who just don't want to buy insurance? Who's coming?
Oh no, the demographic is all over. But there's mothers with their kids. There are people who just don't have any other way to get health care. I haven't seen anyone that looks like an actor so far.
Well, and what are they telling you about why they don't have health care?
There's really two categories. There's the uninsured, and you know that there's around 47 million nationally. There's several million just in this area that have no insurance. There's a lot who have insurance but don't have dental insurance. And I talked to a mother yesterday that had a terribly painful abscess tooth. You can't go to an ER and get your teeth fixed, or they don't have vision insurance. So we're doing a lot of dental and a lot of vision.
We understand, too, there are people, according to the Los Angeles Times, who were insured up till a few months ago but then lost jobs or are insured but don't have enough coverage.
That's correct. And the state has discontinued a lot of the programs that were available, public aid programs, especially in dentistry. So they've been kind of left high and dry.
Are you going to have to turn people away, or are you going to be able to treat everyone?
We certainly will have to turn them away, and that's the lousy part of the job, is that you've got to go out at some point and tell them we can't see anymore. We're working 12-hour shifts. It's a long day, and we're putting as many people as we can through, but there's a finite limit.
Well, and we understand that you are financed through donations. You're staffed with volunteers on a day like today. Are you surprised at the response? You've been in, as we said, developing worlds. Are you surprised at the response in Los Angeles?
Not really surprised. It's the biggest that RAM has done. But we've had the same kind of turnout everywhere that we've gone. And it started out in third world countries, but now we're mainly doing the clinics here in the U.S.
Look, it would seem to cry out for the kind of healthcare reform that people are talking about, a universal insurance where there'd be some sort of a public policy for people like this that would compete with private policies, some sort of affordable public policy for them. But what do you say to people who say, wait a second, I pay for my insurance, I scrape together every penny I have, I give up other things. How can you get across the need that you're seeing?
A lot of them are working poor that don't have insurance from their employers, or they have insurance that the deductible is so high they can't afford to pay it. They're responsible citizens, but they're just out of the healthcare system. They just don't have that safety net of insurance or a public program that they can go to.
That's Don Minnelli, a member of Remote Area Medical. The Tennessee-based nonprofit is holding a free medical, dental, and vision clinic in the Forum in Inglewood, California this week. Don, thanks for speaking with us.
You bet.
Well, perhaps you heard the recent brouhaha over Burmese pythons in Florida. Journalists and waders reporting from swamps. Photo ops of python hunters with their latest catch. It had a very serious start. Last month, a 2-year-old girl appeared to have been strangled to death by her mother's boyfriend's 9-foot pet Burmese python. That man may face charges because his pet didn't have the permits that the state requires for pythons and other constrictors. And there may have been a few cases of pet Burmese pythons killing humans in Florida. But now state and local politicians are proposing banning importation of the snakes. And the state is also going after Burmese pythons in the wild, which have reportedly never killed any Floridians. Some estimates have up to 100,000 Burmese pythons slithering around the state. And the Florida Wildlife Commission has now licensed a handful of hunters to find, kill, and study the wild Burmese python. The snakes aren't indigenous to the U.S. They only began to appear in the Everglades in the mid-1990s. So how'd they get there? Biologist Sean Heflick is one of those licensed python hunters. He's also president of the Central Florida Herpetological Society. He's conflicted about hunting them. We spoke recently and asked him to describe the python problem as he sees it.
Well, first let me say that the problem is definitely an ecological problem, an environmental issue. This specific python's in the wild is not a public safety issue. These animals are spread across 1 million acres of wild Everglades, and it is a problem because they are a large python, they're a large constrictor, and they have the potential to consume quite possibly an endangered or threatened species that are already critical as far as populations go. You've got wood storks, you've got a lot of different birds that I know the National Park System and the biologists within are concerned about. You have the Key Largo wood rats, which they're concerned about, and everything in between. And it's really a balance. The question is whether this python is going to supplant another large predator like the alligator, which I have my doubts about. They've been around a long time. And whether or not they may contribute to the demise of a threatened or endangered species out there.
Well, you point out they're not in areas where people go that much, but you're not concerned about them becoming a public hazard?
No, I really don't. This python has been billed the gentle giant of the pet industry, and that's because they typically don't have the characteristics that some of the larger pythons or the larger constrictors do, and they become real docile when handled and when they're captive born. And, you know, they're not out there hunting for humans. They're minding their own business in the wildlands. And, you know, I go out there and I try to find them. I'm a biologist by training, and it's also what I do. And I have a hard time finding them. So I don't think it's a really big issue for the general population who, A, is not out in the wild in the Everglades, and who, B, isn't looking for them to boot. I mean, we got, what, an estimated 1.5 million alligators in the state? And, you know, we seem to get along fine in the waterways. And, you know, we have sharks in the seawater, and we do fine.
Well, and how did they get there? I mean, we know there are theories that they were unleashed because of Hurricane Andrew, which devastated that region back in 1992. There's also the old New York City story. Maybe people bought them as pets and then flushed them down the toilet or drove them out into the wild when they couldn't care for them anymore. What's your sense of why they're there?
Well, I'll tell you. In my opinion, my professional opinion as a biologist, I think that this population does indeed stem from 1992 and Hurricane Andrew. You're talking about a Category 5 massive, monstrous storm picking up and literally demolishing homes, massive buildings and structures, picking up buses and tossing them. So when you look at that and know that you had, you know, facilities like Miami Metro Zoo, there was at least one facility down there that we're aware of in South Florida, right almost in the epicenter of that, that was totally demolished. And within its walls, weak, shaky walls at that, there were hundreds of these Burmese pythons that were babies. And those babies at that small size could be carried for long distances. And even if they weren't carried on the wind, the massive amount of storm surge and water that was there. These animals are very at home in the water and can do quite well in aquatic habitats. One of the things that the people need to be asking themselves is if these were pet releases that really got this population going. Most of the Burmese python in the pet industry right now are of genetic mutations. They're albino, they're cinnamon colored, they're green, they're patternless, you know, all of these different mutations. So if these are pet industry releases, where are all of these mutations? Why haven't we found albinos or cinnamons or, you know, some of the other mutations? And as babies, they won't survive. That's true. But if people are releasing them, they're releasing the big ones. That's what everybody's saying. So where are these big animals? Where are the genetic mutations in this population? That's an important question.
Well, now you're out hunting these now huge pythons, reportedly 100,000 of them across the Everglades. First of all, how do you do that? You just walk along and carefully?
Well, there are multiple ways, and let me say that that 100,000 is a guess. You know, originally it went from a couple thousand to 10,000, and it sat at 30,000 for a long time. And then, as much as I hate to say it, some of our politicians in the Senate and the Congress got involved, and all of a sudden they must have started populating themselves like rabbits. Because it became exponential, and all of a sudden we're at 100, 150, 200,000 pythons. And it's anybody's guess. It really is. But I can tell you this. We go out on foot. We go out on 4x4s. We go out on airboats and other watercraft, and it's hard to find them.
How many have you found?
Well, just started on that Friday. We caught that one right off, and then I caught another one the other day. So the grand total right now under the program is 2.
Well, and we know that they're being studied. The ones that are captured are being studied to see what it is they're eating. Have you opened one up?
I have. Matter of fact, we're obligated and actually mandated to euthanize these animals. And the one that we captured on the kickoff day on that Friday, July 17th, had one rat remains, had some toe bones and the fur of a rat, which is expected. And the one that was captured just this weekend had absolutely nothing in its stomach. And it looked pretty weak. It was not in good health. It was rather skinny, not a lot of fat stores. So at least that one python wasn't doing so hot out there.
So as somebody who I would imagine likes snakes, you're the head of the Herpetological Society, how do you feel about this mandate to go out and kill them?
Well, it's a mixed bag. I do love these animals. I used to breed them. I don't know what else you would do with them. It's not like we're going to put them into the pet industry. They've never been a pet snake, and they're born in the wild, they're raised in the wild, and they have wild tendencies. I mean, they're full of internal parasites at that point in time, and it doesn't really make sense to try to hold on to them and keep them alive. And humane euthanization is really the only option.
That's Sean Heflick, python hunter and president of the Central Florida Herpetological Society, one of several python hunters licensed by the state of Florida to go root out the pythons in the Florida Everglades. Sean, thanks for speaking with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And by the way, since we spoke with Sean, hunters have now caught 10 pythons total under the state's program, and questions are still being asked, is it worth it? When we come back, a journalist who says researchers say this new biodiversity is not a bad thing here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We just heard about wild Burmese pythons in Florida, where lawmakers are looking to restrict the importation of pet pythons and have authorized a hunt for the wild ones. And some are asking, why? Burkhard Bilger, staff writer for The New Yorker, recently wrote an article called Swamp Things, Florida's Uninvited Predators. He says the pythons are just one of the massive amount of non-native species finding their way into the Florida ecosystem. Burkhard, you say the situation in Florida is kind of like the old alligator flushed down the toilet story, repeated 1,000 times with 1,000 species. So tick off. What else is out there?
Well, I mean, Hurricane Andrew famously released lots and lots of primates, for instance. I think 3,000 to 4,000 primates got released by the hurricane. You had baboons running in the street. You had one band of juveniles that broke into a family's weight room and was just lifting weights when the Park Service people found them. You had antelopes running down the highway. You had cobras loose. I mean, it was just, you know, I think the estimate was 15,000 exotic animals got released by the hurricane alone. So that's been a huge kind of injection, as he said, into the Florida environment. But then this has been going on for decades in Florida. I think every year about 12,000 shipments of exotic animals come into the port of Miami, and some of them get loose. I think the estimate typically is that 1% get loose. 1% of those survive, and 1% of those become pests. So over the years, that's become just an enormous kind of an open-air zoo in that state.
Well, that was incredible to read. How is that possible? Where's the regulation of exotic wildlife?
Yeah, I mean, since 1900, they've had a law that keeps out what they call injurious species. And these are things like Indian wild dogs and flying foxes and noxious weeds like devil's thorn or giant hogweed. And these are things that were known by farmers and settlers to be injurious to the environment, and they were kept out. But it's always been a very short list. The most famous example of that is the brown tree snake, which kind of decimated all the songbirds in Guam, and people really worry about it coming into Hawaii and killing all the songbirds there. But the law is essentially right now that there's a blacklist. The scientists I spoke to all felt like what we really need is not a blacklist, but a whitelist. You need to say, okay, here are the animals that you can import into the United States. If you can prove that this animal is fine, that it won't become an invasive pest, that it won't eat endangered species or be a threat to people, then you're fine to bring it in. But until you can do that, it won't be allowed in. That sounds great. It's very, very hard to enforce. It's very hard to prove scientifically that an animal is bad for the environment, or even harder to prove that it's not bad for the environment. How do you, short of letting something loose in a huge acreage and seeing what happens, how do you really prove that an animal isn't becoming an invasive pest? Biologists themselves over and over again told me, we just don't know yet. So it's a very hard case to make. And the pet industry has just, you know, been able to shoot down these efforts pretty easily by saying, look, you're going to cost us enormous amounts of money without any really good hard science to back up your contention. So it's a very tricky path for the biologists to walk who want to do this.
You say that it takes 10 years, up to 10 years, to get something banned from the country. Well, meanwhile, you paint incredible scenes of what is going on because of all the species unleashed across Florida. Just give us a sense of them. I'm thinking of the python that was discovered with a 6-foot alligator inside that had sort of kicked its way out of its stomach. It just, you know, bizarre biology.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was a 13-foot python that swallowed a 6-foot alligator. There are scenes like that going on in Florida all the time. I mean, there's a little kind of a state in the middle of Florida that has a population of boa constrictors that have just kind of found nice little warm holes to nest in. They haven't spread out yet, but most people say they probably will. There have been anacondas that have been caught in Florida. They haven't yet established a population. Most people think they could. It would actually be quite at home in Florida. The most dramatic example of this that I found was in Cape Coral on the west coast south of Tampa Bay, where this population of these giant lizards called Nile monitors has become established. Now, these things are kind of like the smaller version of a Komodo dragon, but they still get up to 7 feet long. They're incredibly intelligent. They hunt in packs like velociraptors. They will eat almost anything they can get their hands on, and have just been snatching up poodles and people's pets. And there are now several thousand of them, there seem to be, in that area. Cape Coral is one of these towns that famously was dredged up out of swampland. And they did this by creating about 400 miles of canals throughout the town. So every house backs up on a little piece of canal. And these monitor lizards just kind of swim up the canals and make these little darting raids into people's backyards and snatch their pets or threaten their children and carry their booty back into the swamp and eat it. So it's a pretty amazing place to be. You kind of think you're in suburban America and suddenly you're in, you know, the wild kingdom.
And as we said, maybe that's just the way Florida's going to be. I mean, you point out that the pet trade is worth more than $40 billion a year in the U.S. Nearly 100 million Americans own exotic animals. That's part of where this problem comes from. The other is hurricanes unleashing these animals. That's going to happen again. So what do you see as the future here?
Well, I think part of what's going to happen is our ecosystems are going to become more homogenous. There's even a term, homogenocene, that some biologists use for it, because it's just very hard to prevent the kind of porousness of modern society with boats and shipments and airplanes and travelers. I mean, you know, there's a lot of smuggling, people wrapping snakes around their bellies or carrying pygmy marmosets in their fanny packs. You know, there's just a lot of transportation of these animals back and forth, and it's hard to prevent that. I also think the kind of the brighter side of it, and that some biologists talk about, is look, there is room in these ecosystems for more animals. The fish biologists in Florida talk about how worried they have been about the importation of exotic fish. But in these canals, I think the population of exotics has tripled in the last couple of decades, and yet none of the natives have gone extinct. Florida seems to be a place that was kind of isolated and didn't get all the species that a typical tropical area would get. And so there are all these kind of gaps in the ecosystem that these exotics have filled in. And it could be that a lot of people argue that Florida is just becoming a richer place in terms of its biodiversity.
Burkhard Bilger, a staff writer for The New Yorker, he wrote the piece Swamp Things, Florida's Uninvited Predators in the April 20th issue. Burkhard, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Okay, quick note. Tomorrow on Here and Now, an Iraqi businessman opens a nightclub in Baghdad, but some of his dancers still have to cover up until they get inside. We'll have that story tomorrow. Still ahead today, Alzheimer's patients go to the museum. We'll see what happens. After the news, Here and Now. The Bureau of Labor Statistics estimates that there are 40 million under 30-somethings working in corporations today, the so-called millennials, born between 1980 and 1999, or some are calling them MOOFers, for the mobile out-of-office technology on which they livestream their every move in blogs and on Twitter. Of course, this doesn't apply to all 20-somethings, but enough that corporate America is looking for help. Our next guest says when a young person leaves after 6 months, it costs the business as much as double their salary to go out and recruit to replace them. Dr. Joanne Sujansky is co-author of Keeping the Millennials, Why Companies Are Losing Billions in Turnover to This Generation and What to Do About It. She joins us from WQED in Pittsburgh. Dr. Sujansky, you say some companies are adapting, but you also give examples of others that are struggling.
Well, actually, one person told us he had 10 millennials in his department, and one by one, either they left or he helped them leave. His feeling was their demands were demands he couldn't meet. They were impatient. They were asking for things that he believed he couldn't deliver. They like flex time. They want to finish a job, finish it well. If it gets done at 3 o'clock, they say, hey, what's wrong with leaving now? And tomorrow, if you need me a few more hours, then I stay and work on the project. They want a place that maybe they can play with the foosball.
You cited some companies actually putting television sets in because this is a generation that's used to having the television going all the time. They're not bothered by having different screens to look at. You talk about nap pods, you know, being put in by companies. And you talk about how this is a generation raised in large part by boomers that has a close, and some have criticized it as a hovering relationship with their parents. How has that carried over into the workplace?
Oh, for instance, a young man is in interviewing for a job, and his mom and dad are out in the reception area. They had come in with him, and he wants to go out to run something by them and come back in. We've had examples of parents pushing to come to orientation. We recommend one of the ways to keep a millennial longer is providing, instead of that one-day orientation, an onboarding program that really looks at the full year and how to do the kinds of things that gets the person feeling a little bit more loyal about the workplace.
So it's a real orientation for them, and also it kind of eases them away from these parents. But you're saying that some companies actually include parents in onboarding millennials?
They absolutely have. For instance, most people have a segment of a day that addresses their benefit plan. So they invite the parents to that perhaps a day of orientation because they've had so many requests from parents to be able to come.
Well, and you know, the way we're talking about this age group, it's making them sound as if they can't function. The fact is, you say this is possibly one of the most functioning, achieving, overachieving generations in a long time. It's just that they're used to a response from their parents when they do well. They're used to immediate responses in everything they do because they've got this technology right there in their hands. Mm-hmm. So you're encouraging companies to do what?
Sometimes corporations make the mistake of having, let's say, a supervisor or a manager in an area. They'll have them talk to the employees about what would be different in the workplace that could make you more satisfied here. We call those keeper interviews. When it doesn't happen, the millennial group gets real disturbed with that because they're used to being heard by their parents and by their teachers. So I think it's real important to do these keeper interviews, ask questions, pay attention, but then give them responses. Anybody more engaged in his or her work feels that they're respected more, they're valued.
That's Dr. Joanne Sujansky. She's co-author of Keeping the Millennials, Why Companies Are Losing Billions in Turnover to This Generation and What to Do About It. Dr. Sujansky, thanks so much.
You're so welcome, Robin. Thank you.
And don't forget, you can always go to our website, hereandnow.org. If you'd like to email us about this story, you can just click on Contact Us. If you want to leave a comment, just scroll down and you can do it right there on the homepage, hereandnow.org. Just ahead, Seth Moulton, a former Marine captain who did several tours of duty in Iraq and is now just back from reporting in Afghanistan. That's after a 30-second break, Here and Now. U.S. Marines say they killed at least 7 Taliban fighters today after an 8-hour firefight in southern Afghanistan, meant to uproot the insurgents from a longtime base and provide security for next week's presidential election. Well, our next guest is a former Marine captain turned part-time journalist who just got back from Afghanistan. 30-year-old Seth Moulton did 4 tours of duty in Iraq, returning to work with his old boss, General David Petraeus. Seth is now a graduate student at Harvard, traveled to Afghanistan as a journalist for Dan Rather's HDNet. And Seth, you said you saw a lot of grateful Afghans in Helmand Province where the troops have been there, U.S. troops in a surge. But there are 2 schools of thought, one from military analyst Andrew Basevich of Boston University, who's questioned why the U.S. is even fighting in Afghanistan when terrorists are in so many other countries. And then there's Anthony Cordesman of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, who wrote in the Times of London this week, the U.S. needs to be there and needs more troops. He says, let's get serious. Where do you stand?
In a sense, I think that both of them have very valid points. I don't think that we have enough troops in Afghanistan today. We've put a tremendous concentration into Helmand Province, for example, but insofar as they just make the Taliban shift to other areas, and we don't have enough troops to cover those areas. I mean, that's a very simple example of why we could use more troops. But stepping back and looking at the whole picture, I think in a sense we do deserve a better explanation from the administration as to exactly what we're doing in Afghanistan today.
Well, but where's the disconnect, Seth? Because you served, as we said, 4 tours in Iraq, and for a while we thought that Iraq policy was being transferred to Afghanistan, that there was a shift in policy in Iraq to, instead of just bombing, to put troops on the ground, pay Iraqis, Sunnis in particular, to take over the fight, and that this idea was being switched to Afghanistan instead of just sending missiles in that might kill civilians, send U.S. troops in who would get Afghan troops to then be the face of the fight in Afghanistan, win some hearts and minds, and do the same thing that seemed to have succeeded in Iraq.
Well, in many ways, these two wars are similar. They're both counterinsurgency campaigns with 2, I think, important strategic goals, one to prevent transnational terrorists from having training camps, the other to prevent regional chaos from a devolving state. And so there are a lot of good parallels in the ways that we can approach them. But there are also some very fundamental differences between the 2 places. I mean, the insurgency in Iraq was largely urban-based, and in Afghanistan it's a very rural-based insurgency. Afghanistan has never had a history of an effective centralized government, whereas Iraq did. As terrible as Saddam was, he was fairly effective at providing a central administration. So I think that that's going to make it much more difficult to apply that kind of model to Afghanistan, and maybe we shouldn't be trying to apply that model at all. But I think another fundamental difference is that we just don't have a very firm and clear strategic plan for Afghanistan at this point. When I was in Iraq in 2007 at the beginning of the surge, you really had this sense that even if you were just a low-level captain, you know, in charge of one neighborhood in Ramadi, say, you understood what you needed to do to secure that neighborhood, but you could also see how providing security in that one neighborhood fit into the larger strategic purpose. That you needed to secure that neighborhood to secure Ramadi, which was the provincial capital of Anbar province. And Anbar province needs security because it represents the Sunnis, and the Sunnis are a very important constituent in parliament, so we need them on board for national reconciliation. And so all the way up, you could see how this fit together. And in talking to the leaders on the ground in Afghanistan today, they absolutely knew what they needed to do to provide security in their area, and they'd learn a lot of lessons from Iraq to help them with that. but they were less clear on what the long-term plan was. They couldn't answer some very fundamental questions, like what do we do about the Taliban if they simply pick up and leave and start operating in other provinces where we don't have enough troops? Or what are we going to do to fundamentally change the Afghan government and security infrastructure here in Helmand to make sure that the Taliban doesn't return when the Marines leave? I mean, if we just put back the same government officials and the same government constructs that were there before, what's different? What's to prevent the Taliban from coming back?
And what was different in Iraq to prevent the insurgents from coming back when U.S. troops, as we said, started paying Sunnis to fight the insurgents themselves?
Well, there's a good example in there, actually, with the security forces. In Iraq, we had this plan to co-opt tribal leaders and to use tribal security forces to help provide the security, to help get the numbers we needed to battle the insurgents. And then we had a clear plan, although it had somewhat rocky execution, for transitioning those tribal security forces, those local security groups, into government jobs and often in the national security forces. And when you put all those numbers together with the surge forces that we put in, the math worked out so that you had enough counterinsurgents to battle the insurgents. When I was down in Helmand province with 1st Battalion, 5th Marines, that battalion had about 1,400 Marines. In that same area, they had 138 Afghan National Police and only 88 Afghan National Army soldiers. Yeah. It's really hard to imagine how they're going to take over for 1,400 Marines.
Before we let you go, Seth, just an image that rises up that you take with you.
I think one of the things that I will always remember about Afghanistan is seeing the bright faces on these young girls and just knowing that in a few years they'd have to be completely covered up in a veil, would never have the opportunity for education, would be oppressed essentially for the rest of their lives, would quickly become part of the 80% of the population that's illiterate. And when you see that, and when you see those kids on a moral and more emotional level, you really want to help.
But you know what people and supporters of the military say, that's not why Marines give their lives, to be almost social workers.
No, that's right. Absolutely. I mean, people like Basevich have a point, which is that, you know, we can't be spending American lives and dollars on education projects. But on the other hand, when you see these young kids, you want to give them a future. There's also a sense in which, you know what, if these kids don't have a future, then they're just going to give rise to another generation of conservative religious radicals who will set out to attack the United States and the Western institutions that are so opposed to that oppressive way of life.
And but one last thought. Is that the major difference between Afghanistan and Iraq? Outside of the major cities, these people are not educated.
That's right. I mean, a lot of Afghans just really have no basic knowledge of the outside world. I remember talking to one Afghan who we said, you know, why do you think the Marines are here? And he just said with a perfectly straight face, well, the American king must have decided to send them here. And that's just the way he understood it. Hmm. And he had no concept for the kind of society that we have, or in a way, the kind of society that we're trying to bring to Afghanistan.
That's Seth Moulton. He's a former Marine captain who just returned from Afghanistan, where he was working as a journalist for Dan Rather's HDNet. We'll see your work in the fall.
That's right. It should be out in September.
Seth, thanks so much for speaking to us about it.
You're very welcome, Robin.
Can anyone see this picture, this photograph
here?
What's going on in that?
It's a parade of some
kind. Yeah.
Like
parade.
Oh,
Tin Man.
All right. Yeah, we're in the parade.
Residents of two assisted living facilities visiting the National Heritage Museum here in Lexington, Massachusetts, on a recent tour designed specifically for people with Alzheimer's. ARTS, spelled A-R-T-Z, stands for Artists for Alzheimer's. It's a nonprofit that's been running these cultural outings for several years now, and they say their trips have a serious purpose. Sean Caulfield is creative director and co-founder of ARTS, along with Dr. John Zeisel, who's president of the Hearthstone Alzheimer's Foundation and author of the book I'm Still Here, A Breakthrough Approach to Understanding Someone Living with Alzheimer's. Sean, we want to ask you about the tours that you help guide in a moment. But Dr. Zeisel first, as a doctor, what do you see happens to patients when they go on the tours?
People become alive. People who see great art and are in front of great art and are focused and are engaged can't also be agitated and anxious and aggressive and apathetic, the big four A's of Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm. Is it progressive? And can something like art slow it down? How does it work, Alzheimer's, that we know?
There are two separate streams. One is the physiology of what's going on in the brain, The other is how people behave and how people feel. And while the physiology is a progressive physiological illness, you can maintain people as people for almost the entire length of the illness.
And how long can the illness run?
12 to 15 years. So we usually see pictures in the media of people at the end of their life, as opposed to the 10 to 12 years. When people with a dementia or with Alzheimer's want to go to the museums, not only museums, but also comedy clubs, theaters, films, the community.
Well, let's listen to a little more. Here the group is viewing an exhibit of folk art, and the guide comes across a papier-mâché mask hanging on a wall. She engages a woman who just revealed something about her family.
It says here, costumed tricksters roam the streets chasing children.
Oh. Well, you know what?
Yeah.
That's what I grew up learning. My mother and her sister were 10 and 8 when they walked across Russia to come to the United States with a group.
Wow. If you created a mask for yourself, thinking about your upbringing and your background, would it look anything like this?
No. My mother believes in peace and quiet.
Much more peaceful, huh?
Well, you know, they had illnesses that nobody knew how to take care of. My aunt tried to walk, and she couldn't. She was 8.
Wow.
It was just pathetic stories. I don't know, there are things I had to do for them because I was the elder child.
Wow.
And my mother and I were buddies. It was really wonderful. Mm. My mother was cute.
The mask, while interesting, is not the purpose of that conversation, right?
Right. We're trying to use that mask as sort of a mirror just to get them to express themselves.
And Dr. Zeisel, how does it work? I mean, it was very powerful to hear this woman immediately talk about her mother wanting peace and quiet. I bet she did, having, you know, as a child walked out of Russia. So we're suddenly learning something about this woman and this household she grew up in. Maybe she had to walk around on tiptoes. I mean, what are you hearing happening there?
I'm hearing that the myth that there are no memories with people with Alzheimer's is busted. I'm hearing that the questions the guide asked, that the mask that they were showing, detoured that woman's mind around whatever dysfunction there was there and got her access to those deep memories. She had, as a result of that story, a sense of who she was. Out of this mythological, I had no memory, no self, no recognition of children, no expression, it's all not true.
One reason we hear so much about people with Alzheimer's losing their memory is because short-term memory is the part of the memory that's most affected. When someone forgets to shut the bath off, they leave the oven on, the police get called, crises happen within the family. Society doesn't emphasize or place a lot of value on the fact that emotional memory, artistic memory, stays with people. We are seeing in our museum program people talking about the visit 2, 3, 4 days later, which goes against the general notion of people with Alzheimer's remembering.
Well, in fact, Sean, let's listen to a moment where you've been showing the group an exhibit of old games. One of the museum goers, a man named John, recognizes the game Mahjong. He knew he was looking at Chinese characters, but he couldn't pull up anything else about the game. Then just minutes later, the group's looking at old black and white photographs of Boston from the early 1900s. And John, the same person who's looking at a Mahjong tile, doesn't know what he's seeing, suddenly comes to life. Let's listen. You begin.
John recognized this right here. What did you say the name of it is?
It was the Waltham Watch Company,
the Waltham
building originally.
Yeah.
But I worked for Raytheon, and we hired that building from whoever owned it at that time. Mm-hmm.
But you recognize it?
Yes, I worked on the second floor of that building.
I think I see you in the window. You're waving. Is that you?
I'm looking at the canoes going by on the Charles River here.
That's a lot of memory. Charles River, Raytheon building. John Zeisel, you're gesturing like, see?
Right.
It was the photograph?
It was Sean's compassion. It was the way Sean respected him and showed him the dignity of being a person who had a job. And it was the visual picture that got the detour around the brain.
Yes, and I think it was what led up to that moment that allowed that moment, enabled that moment to happen. We don't test the brain. We don't ask people, do you remember that painting we saw 15 minutes ago and how it relates to this one? So it's a very safe place, and he was completely open. And when he saw that picture. I don't know how he managed to identify it, because it looked to me, it looked like any other building from the 1930s, but he immediately recognized it.
Data from a national caregiver survey found that dementia caregivers are more likely to be depressed, get sick, lose employment, experience family conflicts than other kinds of caregivers. So what is the impact of having an art experience for them?
What it does for the caregivers is it shows them that the person they love exists, and that they don't have to bring sadness and misery and grief to every encounter. When they arrive with this positive view towards the person they love, the person responds to it. It improves them as well.
But it sounds like what I'm hearing you both say is advice to caregivers. Don't come and greet that person who maybe just went on an art tour by saying, do you remember that picture you just saw 15 minutes ago at the museum? That's not the way to approach it.
Because they'll say what museum and what painting. Absolutely. The approach has to be, you must have had a great time at the National Heritage Museum.
You remind them.
Well, that's every encounter with someone with Alzheimer's. It has to be a reminder. Hi, I'm John Zeisel. I'm your son. I love you.
Well, by the way, since you've mentioned, when you walked in here, I said, you're not by any chance related to Eva Zeisel, one of the country's great sculptors. And you said, well, yes, I am. And she's 102 years old now.
My mother is very cognitively there and sharp as a tack. And she's still going, and she's still interested, and she's still, in fact, doing some work.
Is that really true, that if the elderly keep active, keep making, keep creating, it does help?
We believe that. There's a recent research project that came out of England. They identified that people who retired later had less chance of developing or living with Alzheimer's. I believe that the real message is that staying creative is important. That using your brain for art, museums, for circus, for films, getting out, perceiving, commenting, that's what keeps people alive and awake, even if you have a dementia.
That's Dr. John Zeisel. We also heard from Sean Caulfield. They are co-founders of the group Artists for Alzheimer's, or Arts with a Z. For more, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.